You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about the state of our country's mental health care and why our guest argues there really isn't much of a system for helping Americans with mental illness. Now, Wisconsin Republicans continue to investigate the 2020 election in Wisconsin. This week, their lead investigator released a second report on his findings. Former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman presented those findings to state lawmakers on Tuesday, alleging that the election was conducted unlawfully in multiple instances, though many of those allegations are disputed or have been rejected in courts. Gabelman encouraged lawmakers to consider decertifying the state's election, which the state legislature's nonpartisan attorneys have said is impossible. We're talking now about Gabelman's report, his testimony to lawmakers, and the reaction from elected government officials. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to this report from Michael Gabelman? What about his calls to decertify the election? Do you want Republicans to keep focusing on the 2020 presidential election outcome, or do you think it's time to move on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
Before we get into the content here, this has been described as another interim report. Can you talk about the timeline that has changed over time?
Yeah, this is something where the end time just keeps getting pushed farther out. It was just a couple of weeks ago that you heard Speaker Voss, who hired Mike Gabelman to do this investigation, tell conservative talk radio in Milwaukee, it was WISN, that Gabelman would be releasing his final report at the end of February. He released it, you know, this week on March 1st. But it was Gabelman who described it as an interim report and said right at the beginning of his remarks to lawmakers on this assembly panel that this doesn't end here. You know, he made a point of coming back to that a few times. So we don't know exactly where Speaker Voss is in terms of what Gabelman does next. We do know that he thinks that Gabelman needs to fight all the lawsuits that have been that he's a part of right now connected to this investigation. But Gabelman seems to be the one really pushing the idea that he's not done here.
I want to give a listen to Gabelman encouraging lawmakers to consider decertifying the state's presidential election outcome. This is a thing that caught a lot of attention, of course, on Tuesday. Here's what he had to say about that.
I raise it as a possibility and suggest that if such an avenue were to be pursued, I believe that the conclusions in this report would support such a process.
The legislators, nonpartisan attorneys have said, and legal scholars, most of them have said that's a non-existent process. What's been the response to that call, Sean?
It's been kind of crickets for the most part among Republicans. And, you know, there are a lot of Republicans who are sympathetic to the idea that the election was improperly run in Wisconsin. But you haven't seen Republicans rallying around this idea now that the state can decertify the election. There's one Republican lawmaker who has pushed for it, Timothy Ramthan, a state lawmaker. And he, when he brought it up for a vote in the assembly, he had no co-sponsors. It's going nowhere. And the speaker of the assembly has said it's impossible. So this is something where, you know, Mike Gabelman is kind of on an island here among most people, certainly among most in the legal community where this idea has been, you know, widely rejected.
Now, when it comes to voter fraud, especially widespread voter fraud, did Gabelman offer evidence of concrete cases of voter fraud here?
The way he's framing voter fraud is if an election law was broken. So he's saying that, like, for example, the Wisconsin Elections Commission, eyes wide open, voted unanimously for a policy that would not allow registration deputies to come into the state's nursing homes during the early days of the pandemic. And they renewed that policy during the 2020 election year. And he's essentially saying that because, you know, he views that as an unlawful act, that votes cast under that system were fraudulent. You know, is my reading of the report, because he asserts that this shows fraud, but it's not voter fraud in terms of here's a criminal case that I'm forwarding, you know, like a district attorney would do. It's nothing like that. He's saying because the Wisconsin Elections Commission didn't follow the law, it was a fraudulent election.
We're talking to Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief, looking at the ongoing Gableman investigation, the Republican-appointed investigator of the Wisconsin 2020 presidential election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Ivy is with us in Evansville. Ivy, hello.
Hi. I don't trust Michael Gableman's report because for several reasons. First of all, he said he didn't know how elections were run. Second of all, he was a Trump appointee. Third, the person that is helping him out helped run the Trump campaign. And fourth, he went to Arizona to watch what they were doing with how that audit was run by somebody who had never audited elections or knew anything about them and was a QAnon and Trump supporter. So he doesn't have my trust. Thank you.
Ivy, thanks for the call. One correction. I don't think Gableman had ever been appointed by Trump to any office. He was elected to the state Supreme Court, unless I missed something over that 4 years there, Sean.
Yeah, I'm just unless there was something between when he left the court and now where he was in some way connected to the administration. He was picked for this job by, you know, Speaker Voss and did admit yesterday when asked, he said that he did vote for President Trump. Mm-hmm. So it's not like he's. You know, when you're a state Supreme Court justice, as he was, we officially call them, you know, nonpartisan, but everybody knows which party the justices stand for. There's kind of a song and dance as they dance around that. But here, Mike Gableman said yesterday, I voted for President Trump. And he does seem to be opening the idea to an audit. I mean, he's like the one in Arizona because he's floating this as something that lawmakers should consider. As part of this report.
Now, Gableman had said that raising concerns about his partisan background and his previous statements on the election was unfairly impugning his integrity. I want to listen to a back and forth in the Q&A after his presentation. This is a Democratic Representative Lisa Subek questioning Gableman on Tuesday.
What's interesting is that you went through this list of folks who were involved in different ways with the grants or other things, and tried to connect them through their past up to how they might have partisan leanings. And most people have partisan leanings of some sort, right? We all can acknowledge that. I guess that I could very easily do the same for you.
So the debate over whether Gableman was a, I guess, reliable investigator based on his partisan leanings and his statements early after the election, raising questions about the outcome.
He was at a Trump rally a couple days after Joe Biden won Wisconsin in November of 2020, casting doubt on the results. And his appointment to this special counsel position was announced by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, you know, not in a boring legislative memo, but to a crowd of Republican activists at the state Republican Party convention at a time when President Trump was pressuring Voss and other Republicans to do more to overturn the 2020 election.
Ivy, thanks for calling in. We'll go to Jim next in Janesville. Jim, hello.
Hello. So since this is being funded by taxpayer dollars, when's the end to it? I'm starting to get the feel that since so many of these suits have been brought up and none of them have had any validity that some of these lawyers are looking like grifters, and Gableman's starting to follow that line.
Jim, thanks for the call. Sean, is there any end in sight here?
We have not been given an end in sight right now, no. And, you know, Justice Gableman did kind of say he's not sure what role he'll continue this investigation in, but that he's not going away, essentially. One of the things that, I guess if we've been given any kind of a timeline by the Assembly Speaker, who again hired Gableman to do this work, is that he wants these lawsuits connected to the Gableman case to play out. So Gableman has been sued by a liberal watchdog group over open records. There's a few cases on that playing out. Gableman has sued several officials, including the mayors of Madison and Green Bay, seeking to jail them if they don't comply with his subpoenas to sit for private interviews. That case is still playing out. There was a hearing scheduled for it in April. And then you have also a case that was filed against Gableman, challenging his subpoena power by the Wisconsin Department of Justice, representing the Wisconsin Elections Commission. That's still playing out. So while these cases are still playing out, challenging his authority and challenging kind of the secrecy of the investigation, it seems like Speaker Voss has indicated that Mike Gableman will stick around.
We're talking to Sean Johnson, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief, looking at the interim findings of the Wisconsin Republican-backed investigation of the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of calls from the lead investigator to decertify the presidential election outcome in 2020, which state lawyers and outside lawyers say isn't a thing that they can do? Do you want this investigation to keep going or to end? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our look at Wisconsin Republicans' election investigation and Michael Gableman's latest report on that investigation. WPR's Sean Johnson stays with us. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Sean, before we go back to our callers, one question that Gableman was asked during this session was, are you under contract? And the answer was kind of complicated.
It was the one part of the hearing where he did not sound sure of himself and kind of said that there's different interpretations of that, that some people, that he believed he's under contract, but that some people would say his contract ended on the 31st of December, because that's the last document that was, that's publicly available showing him under contract. And in fact, there was a ruling in one of those open records cases yesterday by a Dane County judge that said he is not under contract, that based on the information before the court, his contract ended in at the end of October. So that gets at a pretty big issue here, because you're talking about his authority under, the law vested in him by the state assembly to do a pretty sweeping investigation of, an exercise of democracy. So it's not a small thing. And as of right now, Justice Gableman is saying, I believe I am under contract. Speaker Voss did not respond to questions about whether he had the same view. But a judge yesterday said that Gableman is not.
And already lawyers for the city of Green Bay have responded to one of his requests saying, we'll give it to you, some information to you, because we're nice. But technically, if you're not under contract, you're just a guy, right? I mean,
they're kind of saying it's a courtesy. We don't know that you're representing anybody here, but we'll give this to you as a courtesy. That is the situation there, and you can imagine they will point that out to judges in these myriad cases.
Let's go back to your calls now. Jerry is with us in Waukesha. Jerry, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to bring up, Jerry? Yep, go ahead.
I want to talk about a few different things there. I've been following this quite closely. I'm involved in some conservative groups that have people working on this. I met Mr. Gableman a couple of times. I've got no reason to judge his credibility. I think he's upstanding. He's only following the money and following the events as they took place and connecting the dots as he did so the other day in Madison. We got to fix the problems. We can't have a Venezuela election in November of this year and November of 24. I think the country will come unglued. I don't know what the results were from Arizona and what the election inspectors found there. I never dug into that because I'm not from Arizona, but what I do know about Wisconsin is appalling. What was done voting in July in Madison in the park, who the hell does that? Third world countries do that, not America.
Jerry, so we gotta fix. Thanks for the call. That is a concern, the so-called democracy in the park. Sean, that was ballot boxes with poll workers at them where people would take their filled out ballots and drop them off in those boxes. Is that something that Gableman is focused on?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it wasn't in July, but it was during the absentee voting period where people had filled out their absentee ballots at home. And then instead of putting them in the mail or putting them in a drop box, they took them to these Democracy in the Park locations that were set up by the clerk. I mean, we should mention this was the attorney. There were attorneys that sort of asked for a lawsuit if there was going to be one. You know, people who wanted to defend these events said, you challenge these in court if you think there's something wrong here. No lawsuit was brought against the Democracy in the Park events, but they're certainly something that we have talked about quite a bit since then.
Thanks for the call, Jerry. We'll go to Scott next in Madison. Scott, hi.
Hi. If they do decide to overturn the election, will that be the entire ballot so that any laws that have been passed since that election would be have been made by illegally elected people?
Scott, thanks for the call. That's been brought up, Sean, that if somehow, hypothetically, the election were decertified, that wouldn't necessarily just affect the presidential outcome, but the entire assembly and half the Senate at the same time.
Yeah, and I mean, Gableman's report totally glosses over that completely. And his remarks to the assembly committee this week didn't address that either. He was asked about, you know, why you had, I guess it's not a discrepancy, but it's like split ticket voting. You know, why would somebody like Mike Gallagher do well, a Congressman Mike Gallagher up in Green Bay, do well at the same time Joe Biden would do well? I mean, there was a time in Wisconsin history where I don't think people would question that so much. We have split ticket voters here. Think about like the Obama Walker voters of 2012 was a thing we talked about a lot. And Gableman said, you know, I can't explain that. And he sort of left it at that. And he didn't attempt to offer an explanation for that. Because if you're talking about decertifying the entire election, that would be a lot of offices. And they seem to want to confine it to the presidential election, but don't explain why it would be that office and not others.
Thanks for the call. We should key in. There were some video presentations where a lawyer who'd worked with a legal group that had sued, filed a variety of lawsuits related to that election, made videos of care facility residents, and I asked them questions. Can you tell us what was going on there, Sean?
So this got at that decision by the Wisconsin Elections Commission to waive the normal rules for voting in these residential care facilities, where normally you'd have these special voting deputies come into the facilities to administer elections, bring ballots, assist residents with voting. And because of COVID and you had a number of facilities shutting down, the Elections Commission made the decision, that they weren't going to do that. And as a matter of public health, that the people who were in these homes were at the greatest risk of COVID because of their age and pre-existing health problems. And so that's why the Elections Commission made the decision that it did. What Gableman is arguing and what the attorney who made those videos who worked with him, Eric Cardall, with the Thomas More Society, what they're saying is that without this oversight, nursing home residents were coerced to vote and potentially vote a certain way. They haven't like brought that forward to the degree of filing complaints against specific nursing home workers. But that's the allegation that they're making, is that without this normal process in place, you lost a safeguard. What you did see Gableman do is kind of extrapolate these videos of people. And I should mention the videos. You asked about the videos. I mean, what's happening is Eric Cardall, this attorney, is interviewing some of these elderly residents to ask them about their voting preferences. In some cases saying, candidate A, wants to spend more. Candidate B wants to cut taxes, like kind of offering these hypothetical scenarios and then saying, who do you support? And then, the residents were confused at times. And these are very elderly people in some cases. And the point that they're trying to make is that they, you know, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but the implication is that they couldn't or shouldn't have voted. And that is not the law in Wisconsin. I mean, they have a right to vote for whatever candidate you choose. Their process is by which somebody could be removed, but that goes through the courts.
Mm-hmm. Time for one more caller. Rick is with us in Evansville. Rick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if there is anyone or any way that we can push back or hold Speaker Voss, Dishonorable Mr. Gableman, any of these other officials, and push back and hold them accountable and responsible as a fifth column attempting to disrupt and delegitimize the votes of the people.
Rick, thanks for the call. Don't have a lot of time left. Sean, that is that's the accusation that's been made by, I think, Governor Evers, Attorney General Call, and many others in their responses, saying there's an effort here to delegitimize our election system.
That is definitely what you're seeing. I mean, the pushback at this point is coming in the court system from a variety of sources, from people representing the mayors and others who Gableman has subpoenaed in Wisconsin, from Attorney General Josh Call. These sides are kind of fighting it out in a number of courts right now. And so that's sort of where the friction is at this point, because in the legislature, Democrats can ask questions. They can kind of make a point of how they view this investigation, but they can't do anything about it. And it's in the legislature. It's kind of out of Governor Tony Evers' hands, too.
Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief, with us to talk about Michael Gableman's report as part of the 2020 election investigation backed by Assembly Republicans. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, two conversations about Russia and Ukraine, including a look at Russia's nuclear arsenal and the history of Russian-Ukrainian relations. That and more tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. World Cheese Championship today in Wisconsin. Dean Kinetter, go.
Yes, Rob. The champion was announced earlier this afternoon, and the winner is Gormino Gruyere, made in Switzerland. It's the third time this cheese has been a world champ. That's the bad news. The good news is 6 Wisconsin cheeses did make the top 20 in the world across a big variety of styles. So, you know, there's a lot to celebrate there, and it's cool to see our cheesemakers getting some recognition on the world stage.
You hungry for some cheese tonight, Dean?
Oh, definitely. I'll stock up regardless, Rob. And look forward to 2024 when we get our next shot at the championship.
Wait until next time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Barrett. In his first State of the Union address earlier this week, President Biden announced a strategy for addressing the national crisis around mental health. In a fact sheet the administration released Tuesday, it says the plan is to, quote, strengthen system capacity, connect more Americans to care, and create a continuum of support, transforming our health and social services infrastructure to address mental health holistically and equitably. In his new book, our guest says changes to mental health care are long overdue, but there's good news. He says we know what works. We mostly just need to put it into action. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you struggled with mental illness or know someone who has or is doing it right now? What kinds of help have you been able to find? What isn't out there that you wish were out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Thomas Insel is a psychiatrist and neuroscientist who served as director of the National Institute of Mental Health from 2002 to 2015. He started two online platforms to help people with mental illness. He's a special advisor to California Governor Gavin Newsom and the past chair of the board of the Steinberg Institute in Sacramento, focused on brain health policy advocacy. His new book is called Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. Dr. Insel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
On Monday, you wrote on Twitter, quote, I've waited 41 years for a president to talk about mental health. Biden says we have a mental health crisis. Finally, we have an agenda, end quote. Can you expand a bit on what you were seeing from the White House here?
Well, I think what you heard on Tuesday was pretty exciting. Biden's actual words were, in the spoken State of the Union, let's take on mental health. But he didn't say a lot. There was a lot of other things to cover in that hour speech. What the White House did earlier in the day was to release a fact sheet that you had just mentioned at the top of the show, talking about the need to go deep in a few areas, especially around building capacity, connecting people to care, and even thinking beyond healthcare about what we need to do to improve mental health, working in schools, working for people who are justice involved, looking at the opportunities to build or rebuild a safety net for those people who may be struggling with severe mental illness. I'm excited about this. I think that it is the first time in really since the Carter administration that the White House has said that we care about mental health as a national issue.
You spend time in your book looking at kind of the crisis of mental illness we have in the country, and we'll get into that. But I want to start, I think, with what seems to me the main takeaway of your book, a very hopeful one, that we have a lot of things that we know can work that can really help people recover. Could you share some of that hope with us?
Absolutely. You know, when most people, when we talk about mental health care and mental health treatment, they immediately start to argue about medications. Are we over-medicated? Are we under-medicated? The fact is, we have a lot to offer, not only for medications, but with psychological treatments and with some new, what we call neuromodulatory treatments like magnetic stimulation. But maybe the most important and least appreciated are all the things that we do in the general realm of helping people recover. Things like support for finishing school or getting a job or getting better housing, bringing families into the mental health crisis space so that we can make sure they know how to become part of the solution. There's a lot we can do that we haven't been doing. Some of it isn't particularly high tech. Some of it isn't particularly sexy, but these kinds of rehabilitative services, they really do work. And we know they help people recover. We've had that data for a long time. We're just not paying for them, and we're not often getting them done.
A big concern that you talk about in your book is a large number, maybe 40% is one number you cite, of people who could use some kind of mental health care, any kind of mental health care, have basically zero or maybe an emergency room crisis visit, and that's it. What would it take to get the services they need in a way that they can access them?
Well, access is part of it, right? In many parts of the country, and Wisconsin is no different than anywhere else, there are areas where it is difficult to find anybody in a community who has the expertise to help with these problems. Fortunately, now we can find people online, and there are many, many new services, many of which developed just during the pandemic, to provide high-quality mental health care. You know, it's a little different than if you needed high-quality surgical care. You actually have to go to a place that has an operating room and be in the same space. For mental health, you can get a lot of what you need by talking with someone who might be remote. And so telehealth has really changed, I think it's really fundamentally changed the way that we provide mental health care. President Biden spoke about that. The fact sheet talks specifically about we need to actually change some of the regulations to make telehealth even easier. But this business of less than half of the people who should benefit actually getting the benefit is not just a problem with access. Mm-hmm. It's also it's a problem with what I call engagement. You know, there's a lot of things that make it difficult for people to get the kind of care they need. And sometimes it is, in fact, there's no one around. But sometimes the illness itself gets in the way. If you're depressed, you're hopeless. If you're anxious, you're avoidant. And if you're psychotic, you probably don't think you're sick. So these are all issues we don't deal with much in the rest of medicine. When people with diabetes or heart disease get ill, the sicker they get, the more likely they are to get care. But in the mental health space, it's just the opposite. The more ill you become, the less likely you are to actually engage in care.
Talking to Dr. Thomas Insull. He's a psychiatrist, neuroscientist, author of the new book, Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. I want to follow you on a trip you made to Italy, the city of Trieste, where you found an example of maybe something we could aspire to. The cab driver I think you went with brought it up as a point of civic pride, even though he didn't know you were working in this field and going there to do research. What were they doing there that maybe could be a model for what we could do here?
Well, there have been several places that have focused on optimizing mental health care. And what Trieste has done over really four decades is to create services within the community. They do have a hospital where people go and when they need to be hospitalized, but what they spend an awful lot of time doing is making sure people are getting the kinds of services that they need to be able to truly recover. So our system here in the United States is mostly focused on symptoms. You know, what we try to do is to make sure that somebody who is depressed or psychotic has relief from those acute symptoms. And often that's done in a crisis. Trieste has made a longer term commitment to say, yeah, we'll help with symptoms, but let's make sure that somebody with a mental illness actually recovers. They actually have a life. So we don't have to worry about suicide because they have something to live for. And even though they may have a psychotic illness, they can still hold a job and have a family. And it turns out that with the appropriate kinds of interventions and with supporting people over the long term, recovery is entirely possible for the vast majority of people with a mental illness, even with very severe mental illness. They don't have to become homeless. They don't end up being incarcerated. And what you see in Trieste is many of them really do thrive, something that should be a source of civic pride. But unfortunately, in the United States, we haven't yet reckoned with the severity of this problem or made the commitment to actually help people recover.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Drew is with us in Fitchburg. Drew, hi.
Hi. Thanks for discussing this topic. I wanted to convey that my wife is seeking licensure in the mental health field here in Wisconsin. And I'm helping her do a lot of legwork with that and have found many, many speed bumps along the way. It has given a good, or I should say bad name to bureaucracy, trying to go through this process. And in a state where there is a dearth of qualified, licensed mental health professionals, it seems like the process should maybe not be easy, but attainable.
Drew, thanks for the call. Dr. Insull, do you see this, that there may be too many hurdles? Is that a concern you have?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question. We don't talk about it enough. You know, we complain a lot about the workforce, but saying we don't have enough therapists or enough providers. But the reality is we don't make it easy. Drew's absolutely right. We have the same situation here in California where you could have been a very successful provider, clinician, therapist in an adjacent state, but you start all over again when you come to California. And I remember at one point, my daughter, who is a social worker and a therapist in a private practice, when we lived in Maryland, in suburban Washington, D.C., she wanted to practice to see patients in Virginia. And it wasn't possible. You need to get an entire different kind of certification for crossing state line that's just 5 miles away. That doesn't really make a lot of sense. We should have national standards. It is important to have standards, but we shouldn't make people who have gone through a lot of training and have a lot to offer jump through so many hoops as they move from state to state. I don't see the sense of that. And it gets even more bizarre when you think that so many people are providing care remotely by teletherapy. And yet they're told they can only do that to somebody who is in the same state. So we actually literally have people on the East Coast who drive up the New Jersey Turnpike from Maryland or Pennsylvania to be able to talk to their patients who are in New Jersey, because they're not allowed to talk to them from their homes in Pennsylvania or Maryland. So we ought to fix that. And it's one of the things actually in the White House plan, they talk about trying to update our teletherapy rules and to Drew's point, just put fewer speed bumps in the way for people who want to provide care.
Thanks for the call, Drew. We are talking to Dr. Thomas Insull, a psychiatrist, neuroscientist, former director of the National Institute of Mental Health. His new book is called Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad to hear the president declare a mental health crisis and announce a strategy for dealing with it? If you have had a mental illness problem yourself or in your family, were you able to get help that you needed or that your loved one needed? If you provide a mental health care, love to hear from you and what you think we need that we don't have right now. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verich. We continue our talk with psychiatrist and neuroscientist Dr. Thomas Insull, looking at his new book, Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. Dr. Insull, you've given some hope here, pointed some towards some of the solutions and tools we have. Can you talk a little bit about the scope and the costs of the mental health problem we have and if we don't treat it and don't fix our system?
Well, the scope is vast. Usually when people talk about mental illness, they say, well, you know, it's like 1 in 5 people are affected. I'm not sure that's helpful as a metric. I actually think more about the fraction of people who have what we call serious mental illness, the illnesses that are really affecting someone's ability to function, that really cause disability, schizophrenia, bipolar illness, some of the eating disorders, sometimes PTSD, severe depression. We have about 14.2 million, so about 1 in 20 people in the United States who are disabled by mental illness, and the cost is enormous. We know that in terms of healthcare, the United States spends about $220 billion, but that's just a tiny fraction of what the actual cost for severe mental illness is. It plays out in the criminal justice system, where so many of these people end up being incarcerated. It plays out in the homelessness crisis, where so much money is going, and most of all, in lost productivity. When you add those three together, the number is really closer to $1 trillion in costs, and so much of that can be averted. We can do so much better considering what we're actually spending by doing it badly, if we were to make the kinds of investments, some of which President Biden alludes to in his document, in his fact sheet, a lot of those costs can come down. So we really ought to think about spending on mental health more as an investment than as a cost, because it helps us on so many other social issues like crowding in the jails, crowding in emergency rooms, and of course, homelessness as well.
Let's go back to our callers now. Joy is with us in West Bend. Joy, hi.
Thank you. This will be a good segue, I think. I'm a nurse. I've worked in mental health and psychiatric inpatient. I have relatives who utilize mental health care, and I believe that mental health is just like any other disease. It's best if you diagnose it early and get treatment early, then you save money in the long run. But a lot of mental health care is paid for only if it's really an emergency or really a crisis. I would like to know what the doctor thinks about this. We have had at least two before three other times when the government has said we'll have mental health parity, and it hasn't really come true. So I'm wondering, how is this program going to be different?
Joy, thanks for sharing your perspective and experience, Dr. Insall.
Well, Joy, you brought up two or three things, and I want to just quickly touch on each of them. It is the case that we have a healthcare system for people with mental illness that is really built around crisis. You're absolutely right. It's really a sick care system and a very expensive, not very effective one. Getting there earlier is the key to fixing this. The Mental Health America, one of the big advocacy groups, talks about their campaign for what they call before stage four. And the problem is that so much of what we do in the mental health space is at a very late stage of these illnesses. We know very, very clearly from the science that if you can intervene early with the first episode of psychosis and provide comprehensive, continuous, and compassionate care, you can often prevent a second episode, help people to recover, make sure that they're working instead of on disability. All of that is feasible. We're just not doing it. On the question of parity, you're right. You know, we've actually had two big parity bills, one in 96, another in 2008 or 9, and neither one of them has really changed the reality, which is that people with mental illness are not given equivalent benefits with commercial insurance to those who have a physical illness. And it was interesting because the president called that out directly. In fact, he made a recommendation that every American with insurance should have up to 3 behavioral health visits a year without a copay, which I've never heard before. I think that was really kind of laying down the gauntlet. But what has happened, even in the past few months, is for the first time, the federal government has begun to return to this issue. It was a federal law, but it was really passed off to the states to enforce parity. And every state did it differently, but no state did it well. The federal government in the last year said, enough already. We want to actually begin to look at this ourselves. So he's asked, the White House asked Marty Walsh, the Secretary of Labor, to begin to do unannounced site visits for Fortune 500 companies and find out, what is it like for someone in that company who wants to get mental health care? They've got an employee-based plan, but are they able to get the services they need, or do they have to go out of network? And if they do, what sorts of costs are incurred? They did this on 10 companies. Marty Walsh had a press conference early in January. All 10 of them were grossly deficient. And so I think you're seeing in that it's kind of like a new sheriff in town. The federal government is now going to begin to look at the actual enforcement of parity in a way we haven't seen really since either of these laws were passed. And I think that's a really promising sign.
Thanks again for the call, Joy. Reading your book, Dr. Insall, I was thinking of, like, by analogy here, if you went to your doctor and the doctor said, yeah, you're at risk of a heart attack. If you have a heart attack, call 911. And that was it. You know, no cholesterol, blood pressure medication, no exercise, no diet advice, anything like that. That's basically the mental health care system for a lot of people, right?
Well, Rob, it's the case that we don't have biomarkers. We don't have good objective measures. They're being developed, but they're not there. And most of all, in this field, we don't measure things very often. So I think that is a real problem. What's really frustrating for me is that we actually have good treatments. Mm-hmm. I think we have something to offer and we're not doing it. Most people get their mental health care from their primary care doc. And that usually means a prescription for an antidepressant or an anxiety pill or something like that. That's not adequate. Now, we should be able to do better. We have great psychological treatments, but people don't get connected to them and often they aren't paid for. We ought to figure out how to make sure that people get the care that works.
In just our last half a minute or so, Dr. Insall, do you think we have the will to do that, to make those investments?
You know, I've wondered about that in the past. I think we're at a particular moment, and this may be one of the silver linings of the pandemic, is that it's helped to focus the nation on this particular problem. It's obviously worse with the pandemic. I have to say that It's one of those rare areas today that's really of bipartisan interest. So I have heard from members of Congress, both on the Republican and the Democratic side, and now the White House as well, that they're all really committed to trying to make a difference. So I'm hopeful. I think this is the time.
Dr. Insull, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, bro.
That's Dr. Thomas Insull, former director of the National Institute of Mental Health. His new book is called Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the January 6th committee says President Trump and associates may have committed criminal acts in their efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election results. A legal expert joins the show for a look at the accusations and what they could mean. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.